Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sama sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sama sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sama sambuddhassa. Buddhang dhammang sanghang namassami. It's wonderful to see so many people here for Vaisakha Puja, day that we commemorate the Buddha's his birthday, the day he became enlightened. It's the full moon of May and passed away into Parinibbana on the full moon. So it's a very auspicious day, and I'm always thinking on these days, like in Thailand, like at Wat Pananachat, they'll be doing a circumambulation like we'll be doing. But it'll be so big that it's like it'll go stretch through almost like the entire inner courtyard with hundreds and hundreds of people. And when the monks start to do their second round, we're kind of waiting for the lay people to start the round. And as everybody's walking like this for the monks seeing the second and third round, it's just, you just look through the monastery and you just see these lights sort of moving in and out between all the trees. And so it's a... has a special feeling this evening for Vaisakha Puja. It's been on the calendar for quite a long time that Ajahn Pasano is going to be in New York. He's actually today was at the United Nations for the Vaisakha Puja celebration, and it was always in the back of my mind was this, you know, that's kind of far off. You know, it's like he didn't even get his ticket, I think, till a couple of days ago. So it was like maybe there was some wishful thinking on my part that the ticket wouldn't come through and he'd be here to give the talk. And so I wasn't really thinking too much about it. But then when he mentioned to me he did have the ticket, there's this sort of sinking feeling like, oh, that means I'll be sitting in the number one seat for the Vaisakha. Oh, no. And so I started thinking about, okay, what are you going to talk about for Vaisakha? And I shared this with the people that were here for the meal today. There's quite a few people came for the meal. And I remember this. I was at Bhavana Society when Bhante Gunaratna was the abbot, and this was over 10 years ago. And it was for Vaisakha, and several hundred people had shown up for the meal, and he was quite praising everybody and making them all feel really good. Like, you know, it's really wonderful that you've come here to make offerings and to support the sangha. And, you know, this is all really good. And he asked sort of like, you know, who here is this your first time? And like almost nobody raised their hands. I was like, okay, you know, this is, you know, people have been coming. You probably all consider yourself to be Buddhist and you're supporting the monastery. And that's really good. And he goes, how many of you have a daily meditation practice? And before, like, everybody had risen their hand like that they were coming. And then about 10, 15 people kind of raised their hand that they had meditated, you know, every day. And he just let into them. He just started yelling at him, what's wrong with you? And if you know Bhante G, it's like you can take it because he's such a loving, he just exudes loving kindness and just a loving grandfatherly figure. But he just started yelling at him, you know, kind of gently, but it's just sort of like, you know, You call yourself Buddhist and you're here to support the Buddhism, but you're not doing what the Buddha told you to do. You're not doing what he taught. And so he kind of lays into him. And then he ended up talking about this monk, Tucho Petila, and gave a kind of a desana about this. And I can't remember at the time if it was just the story of him or if he was actually even referring to this talk of Ajahn Chah's. It probably was because this is a Venerable Ajahn Chah, Tucho Petila, and subtitled Nurturing Buddhism Through Contemplation of Mind. And so I had two thoughts for this evening. One was that I was desperately trying to figure out how to videotape Ajahn Pasano giving his talk at the United Nations, and I was going to project it up here on the wall and get out that way. I thought that'd be really fun and something different. And then we couldn't find it anywhere. And then just 5 minutes ago, Dennis told me it was online. So I was like, ugh. So hopefully we'll be able to videotape it. The next time I give a Dhamma talk and Lumpur's not here, we'll play it. So, but uh, So that's the future potential. But I thought, I just started reading this a few days ago, the Tucho Petila, and I was like, I've read this before, but it was really, really struck me how, of course, you can never go wrong with reading Ajahn Chah. So I just thought I would read this for the Dhamma talk tonight. It's always, during the winter retreat, we take a theme, and this year we took senior Western disciples of Ajahn Chah, and we do like 25, 30-minute readings, just a Dhamma talk from various teachers. And there's a special quality to listening to a talk being read. I always sometimes get this sort of image of being a child at home, you know, sort of having your parents read to you or something like that. So maybe in that spirit you can kind of take this in as, you know, being nurtured by Dhamma. But this is also it's a really good talk, because Ajahn Chah talks about it in various ways, and I'll let you, you know, get from it what you want, what you get from it. But he really does go, you know, really deeply into the mind about, you know, like just looking at sense impressions and seeing how we create our own worlds, our own universes, just based on the sensory impressions that we get. And you know, one level that's completely natural. You know, we hear a sound, and you're naturally going to have, automatically you're going to have a reaction of say annoyance, not liking it, or you're going to like it, or it'll be neutral, and that's just automatic. How it arises. But Ajahn Chah really gives a lot of skills with, you know, like how to work with that. You know, like if it doesn't matter what comes up, but it's what we do with it after that. Do we proliferate? Do we basically, at least by not seeing dukkha, anicca, and anatta. So it's like when we get a strong impression, be it from any of the sense bases, and he focuses then on the mind. So like when a mental quality comes into the mind and we have a reaction to that, it's like, you know, first thing to ask is, you know, okay, in terms of dukkha, is it dukkha? Is it sukha? Is it neutral? And just knowing that, understanding that, and then looking at it in terms of, you know, am I creating a self around this, or am I not creating a self around this? It's just a sense impression that came in, but then we create a whole universe around it and believe it to be true. And that's part of the believing it true is the anicca. We take it to, a lot of times, take it to be permanent, or if it's something like we don't like, then it's just, that becomes all of reality and there's no other possibility. So it's trying to see these things in terms of, is it really permanent? Is it dukkha? Is it sukha? And if it's sukha, then, you know, what's our reaction to that? Because not everything is annoying, but you know, sometimes we get attached to the pleasant and trying to keep a hold of that. So then we see that as, we're not seeing that as impermanent. And we can see our reaction to that, like how are we creating a self around that? How do we, what's our perceptions and feelings? So that just in very summary, that's a lot of this talk. But I will just start reading, and you can take from it what is meaningful for you. There are two ways to nurture Buddhism. One is known as Amisa Puja, nurturing Buddhism through material offerings, such as the four supports of clothing, food, shelter, and medicines. This is nurturing Buddhism by giving material support to the Sangha of monks and nuns so that they can live in reasonable comfort, thus fostering the practice of Buddhism, which in turn leads to the continued direct realization of the Buddha's teachings, bringing increased prosperity to the Buddhist religion. It can be likened to a tree. A tree has roots, a base, a trunk, branches, and leaves. Every single leaf and branch, including the trunk, depends on the roots to absorb nutriment and send it up to those other parts. A tree is dependent on the roots to sustain it. We are the same. Our actions and our speech are the branches, the twigs, and the trunk. The mind is the root which absorbs nutriments and sends it out to sustain the trunk, branches, and leaves, which in turn bear fruit. Whatever state the mind is in, be it based in wrong view or right view, it expresses that wrong view or right view outwardly also through our actions and speech. Therefore, the nurturing of Buddhism through the practical applications of the teaching is very important, In fact, there's nothing else to it. For instance, in the ceremony of determining the precepts on observance days, which we just did, the Ajahn describes these unskillful actions which lay people should refrain from. But if one simply determines the precepts without meditating on or contemplating their meaning, progress is difficult. One will be unable to establish oneself in the true practice. The real nurturing of Buddhism is therefore achieved through patipati puja, the offering of practice, establishing true restraint, true concentration, and true wisdom, sila, samadhi, and punya. Then one will know what it's all about. If one doesn't understand through practice, one won't understand Buddhism. Even if one learns the whole Tipitaka, one still won't know. In the time of the Buddha, there was a monk known as Tuchopitila. Tuchopitila was very astute, thoroughly learned in the scriptures and text. He had 18 branch monasteries and was an eminent teacher, so famous that people all about revered him. When people heard the name Tuchopitila, they were awestruck, and nobody would dare question anything he taught. So much were they in awe of his command of the teachings. Tuchopitila was one disciple in the time of the Buddha who was eminent in learning. One day he went to visit the Buddha. As he was paying his respects, the Buddha said, "Ah, so you've come, venerable empty scripture." Just like that. They spoke for a while about this and that, and then when it was time to leave the Buddha and return to his monastery, "Ah, going back to your monastery, venerable empty scripture." That's all he said. When Tuchopitila arrived, "Ah, so you've come, venerable empty scripture." And when it was time to go, "Ah, so you're going now, venerable empty scripture." He didn't expand on it. That was all the teachings the Buddha gave. Tuchopitila was an eminent teacher, and so he thought to himself, "Now why did the Buddha say that? What did he mean?" He thought and thought, contemplating and going over everything he had learned, until he realized, "Oh, what the Buddha said was true. Venerable empty scripture. A monk who only studies but has never practiced." When he looked into his heart, he saw that really he was no different from lay people. Whatever lay people aspired to, he also aspired to. Whatever lay people enjoyed, he also enjoyed. There was no real samana within him. There was no really profound quality within his mind which could firmly establish him in the way and provide true peace. So he decided to practice. But there was nowhere he could go to. All the teachers he went to see were his own students, and so they wouldn't accept him. Usually when people meet their teacher, they become timid and reverential, and they don't dare speak. So nobody would accept him. He had a lot of learning, a lot of knowledge, so nobody would accept him as a student. Nobody would dare teach or instruct him. Finally, he went to see a certain boy novice who was enlightened and asked to practice under him. The novice said, "Sure, yeah, you can practice with me if you sincerely want to practice. But if you're not sincere, I won't accept you." So Tuchopitila pledged his life as a student of the novice. The novice then told him to put on all of his robes. Now, there happened to be a muddy bog nearby. When Tuchopitila had neatly put on his robes, the novice said, "Okay, now run down into that muddy bog. If I don't tell you to stop, don't stop. If I don't tell you to come up, don't come up. Okay, run." Tuchopitila, neatly robed, plunged into the bog. Squelch, squelch, squelch. The novice didn't tell him to stop, so he kept running until he was completely covered in mud. Finally, the novice said, "Okay, you can stop." So he stopped. "Okay, come on up." So he came out. This clearly showed that he had given up personal pride. He was ready to accept teaching. If he hadn't been ready to learn, he wouldn't have run into the bog, a teacher of such eminence. But he agreed to do it. The boy novice, seeing this, knew that Tuchopitila was really determined to practice. When Tuchopitila had come up, the novice taught him. He taught him to observe the sense objects, to know the mind and to know the sense objects. The novice used the simile of a certain man catching a lizard which had run into a termite mound. The mound had 6 holes in it. Now, if the lizard had run in there, how could one catch it? One would have to close off 5 of the holes, seal them with something, and leave just 1 hole open. Then one would have to sit and guard that 1 hole, When the lizard came out, one could catch it. Observing the mind is similar to this. Closing off the eyes, the ears, the nose, the tongue, and the body, one leaves only the mind. To close off the eye, ear, nose, tongue, and body means to restrain and compose them, leaving only the mind. Meditation is the same as catching the lizard. For instance, when noting the breath, there is sati. Sati is the quality of recollection, as in asking, what am I doing? Sampajanya is the self-awareness that, now I am doing such and such. One observes the in-out breathing with sati, recollection, and sampajanya, self-awareness. That quality of recollection is something that arises in the mind. It's not something that can be learnt from somewhere else. Know the feeling that arises. Perhaps the mind is fairly inactive, and then a feeling arises. There, that's a feeling. Sati goes hand in hand with these feelings. So there is sati, the recollection that I will speak, I will do, I will come, I will go, I will sit, and so on. This is sati, recollection. Sampajanya is the awareness that now I am walking, I am sitting, I am lying down, I am experiencing such and such a mood. With these two things, sati, recollection, and sampajanya, knowledge, knowing oneself in that act of recollection, one will be able to know the activity of mind in the present moment. When it receives such and such an impression, how does it react? We will know this. That which is aware of these impressions is called mind, citta. The impression, aramana, is that which wanders into the mind. For instance, there's a sound, like the sound of the electric plane there. It enters through the ear and travels inwards. The mind acknowledges that it is the sound of an electric plane. That which acknowledges the sound is called mind. Now this mind, which acknowledges the sound, is still quite coarse. It's just the everyday mind. Perhaps we hear the sound of a plane and annoyances arise within the one who acknowledges. We must further train this one who acknowledges to be one who knows in accordance with the truth, Buddho. If we don't clearly know in accordance with the truth, then we may get annoyed at the sounds of people, of cars, of electric planes, or whatever. This is just the ordinary mind which acknowledges annoyances. It knows in accordance with our interpretations, not in accordance with the truth. We must train the mind to know with jnanadasana, the power of the refined mind, so that it knows that the sound of the electric plane is simply sound. If we don't cling to it, then it won't annoy us at all. The sound arises, and we simply know it. This is called truly knowing the arising of sense objects. If we develop the Buddho, if we have clear realization of the sound of the plane, then the sound doesn't annoy us. It just rises according to conditions. The sound is not a being. It is not an individual, a self, an us, or a them. It's just sound. The mind turns over. It lets go. If we know in this way, this knowing is called Buddho. It is the knowledge that is penetratingly clear. It knows the truth. We can just let the sound go on its way. It doesn't disturb us unless we cling to it, thinking, oh, I'm annoyed by that sound. I don't want to hear people speak like that. I don't want to hear sounds like that. So suffering arises. Right there is the cause of suffering. What is the cause of suffering? It's that we don't know the truth of the matter. We haven't developed Buddho. We are not yet clear, not yet awakened, not yet aware. There is just the raw, unpurified mind. It is the mind that is not yet truly useful. Therefore, the Buddha taught to train the mind, train it to be strong. Strengthening the mind and strengthening the body are similar, but are done in different ways. To exercise the body, we must move it around, massage it, stretch it, jog in the morning and evenings, and so on. This is called exercising the body. The body thus becomes stronger, more nimble. The respiratory and nervous systems become more efficient than if we hadn't exercised. Strengthening a mind is not done by making it move around, as is done in strengthening the body, but by bringing the mind to a halt. bringing it to rest. For instance, when we practice samadhi, we take an object, such as the in and out breathing, as our base. This will be the focus of our attention and contemplation. We note the breathing. To note means that we follow the breathing with our awareness, noting its coming in and going out, noting its rhythm. We put awareness into the breath. We follow the natural in-out breathing and try to let go of all else. Our mind will become energized because it has only one object of attention. If we just let the mind think of this, that, and the other, there are many objects of attention. The mind can't unify. The mind won't stop. When we say that the mind stops, we mean that it feels as if it stopped. It doesn't go running about here and there. It's as if we have a sharp knife. If we go and cut away at things at random, like stones, bricks, and grass, without choosing carefully, our knife will quickly become blunt. We must cut only those things which are useful to cut. Our mind is the same. If we let our mind wander after thoughts or feelings which have no use or value, the mind will become weak because it has no chance to rest. If the mind has no energy, wisdom will not arise, because the mind without energy is a mind without samadhi. If the mind hasn't stopped, then one can't clearly perceive the sense objects. The knowledge that the mind is the mind, the object is the object, is the root from which Buddhism has been able to grow. It is the heart of Buddhism. We must cultivate this mind, develop it. We cultivate calm and insight, samatha and vipassana. We train this mind to have restraint and wisdom by letting the mind stop, by allowing wisdom to arise in the mind, by knowing the truth of it. Actually, you know, we human beings, the way we do things, the way we live, the way we are really like little children. The child doesn't know anything. If the adult observes the actions of a child, the way it plays and jumps around, its actions don't seem to serve much purpose. If our mind is untrained, it is like a child. One speaks without awareness and acts without wisdom. One may degenerate but not know it. One may go bad but not know it. A child is ignorant. It just plays as children do. And our ignorant mind is the same. Therefore, this mind should be trained. The Buddha taught to train the mind, to teach the mind. Even though we may nurture Buddhism with our four supports, this is only superficial. It's only the bark or the soft wood of the tree. The real nurturing of Buddhism is the practice, nothing else. The training of our actions, speech, and mind, according to the teachings, which in turn has far-reaching consequences. If we are straight and honest, if we have restraint and wisdom, our practice will bring only prosperity in the future. There will be no sense of jealousy or hostility. The religion teaches us to be like this. Understand it in this way. If we determine the precepts simply in order to follow the established customs, then even though what the Ajahn says is true, we are still lacking in the practice. We may be able to repeat the teachings and to study them, but it remains for us to practice them in order to really understand. If this practice, patipati puja, does not come about, this may well be the cause of our not penetrating the Buddha, Dhamma, and Sangha for many lifetimes, or one can simply say that we don't know a thing about this real essence of this Buddhist religion. It's as if we had a certain fruit, which is said to be sweet and tasty, a good strain of fruit, but having planted it, when it blossoms, we don't smell the blossom. The fruit ripens, and we don't eat the fruit. That fruit isn't much use to us. No matter how good the strain is, we don't know it if we haven't yet experienced the taste of that fruit. Buddhism is like this. If we don't reflect, then we don't understand the meaning of giving, restraint, and meditation, dana, sila, bhavana. Therefore, the practice is like a key, the key of meditation. If we have the right key in our hand, no matter how tightly closed the lock is, when we take the key and turn it, that's all that's needed. If the lock has no key, then it's useless to us. whatever is in the trunk, we can't get at it. That's why the Buddha taught us to study and know these things. Actually, there are two kinds of knowledge. One who knows the Dhamma doesn't simply speak from memory, he speaks the truth. Worldly people usually speak from memory, and what's more, they usually speak out of vanity. For example, suppose there's a certain person who we haven't seen for a long time. Suppose he had lived in a different country or different province for a long time, and then one day we happen to meet on the train. Oh, I'm so glad to see you. I was just thinking to look you up. Actually, that's not so at all. Actually, one hadn't even thought of them, but one says so at the time simply out of gladness. And so it becomes a lie. Yes, it's lying out of heedlessness. Really, one hadn't thought of visiting that person at all. The thought had never crossed one's mind. But a feeling arises at the time, and one speaks accordingly. One lies at that time. This is lying without knowing it. This happens too. It's kind of a defilement. The mind concocts the feeling which causes us to say it. This is a refined form of lying, and actually people tend to speak like this. So, with regard to the mind, Tuchopatila followed the teachings of the novice, breathing in, breathing out, contemplating with sati and sampajanya, with thorough awareness, until he saw the liar within him, the lying of his own mind. He saw the defilements as they came up, just like the lizard coming out of the termite mound. As soon as they arose, he saw them. He perceived their nature. He saw that one minute the mind would create one thing, the next it would concoct another, creating in this way, concocting in that. Thinking is a sankhara dhamma, a sankata dhamma, something which is created or concocted from supporting conditions. It's not a sankata dhamma, that which is neither created nor concocted. The mind, which has been well trained, has good awareness, does not concoct or create mental states. One doesn't have to believe others. One has penetrated to this truth, known as the Arya Satya, the Four Noble Truths. Knowing accordingly to the Arya Satya is knowing according to the truth. One's mental creations will try to get around it and say, that's good, or this is beautiful, or whatever. But if there is Buddha in one's mind, it can no longer lie to one, because one knows the truth of the mind already. It can't create any more deluded mental states. One sees all mental states as unstable, as unsatisfactory, and that one who clings to those mental states will suffer because they are not lasting. Wherever he went, the one who knows was constantly there. Tuchopatila came to this understanding. He looked at the mental states as they arose in the mind. He looked at the various creations of his mind. He saw that the mind lied in many ways. He saw the truth of the matter. He grasped the essence of the practice by saying that, oh, this liar here is the one to watch. Just this is what leads us to extremes of happiness and sadness, making a spin around in the cycle of samsara with its happiness, unhappiness, good and evil, all because of this one. Tuchopatila saw the truth of the matter. He was able to grasp the point, just like the man who caught the lizard. He grasped the workings of the deluded mind. It is the same for us. There is just this one mind, which is the important thing. So it is said that we should train the mind. But if the mind is the mind, what are we going to train it with? If we have sati and sampajanya constantly, we will know the mind. The one who knows is a step further beyond the mind. It is that which knows the state of the mind. The mind is the mind. That which knows the mind is simply mind. That is one who knows. It is above the mind. The one who knows is above the mind, and that is how it is able to look after the mind, to teach the mind to know what is right and what is wrong. In the end, it all comes down to the mind, to this concocting mind. If it is enmeshed in the concoctions and there is no awareness beyond it, then the mind will be spiritually barren. So we must use this mind to hear the teachings, to cultivate Buddha. the clear and radiant awareness that which exists above and beyond our ordinary mind, and know all that goes on within it. This is why the Buddha taught us to cultivate and meditate on the word Buddha, until we know the mind and know beyond the mind. Just observe all the mind's movements, whether good or bad, until the one who knows perceives that mind is simply mind. It's not a person or a self. This is called citta-nupassana, contemplation of the mind. If one sees in this way, one sees that the mind is anicchang, dukkhang, anatta. This mind still doesn't belong to us. It can still lie to us. So we can summarize the above thus. The mind is that which acknowledges the sense objects. The sense objects are the sense objects. The mind we call mind. The one who knows both the mind and the sense object is beyond both. And there is that which constantly purifies. It's known as sati. Everything has sati. Even a cat has sati when it's going to catch a mouse. A dog has it when it barks at or bites people. That's a form of sati also, but it's not sati according to Dhamma. Everybody has sati, but it's like when we say to contemplate the body. What is there to contemplate in the body, they say? Everybody can see it. Kesa, we can see it. Loma, we can see it. Naka, we can see it. Hair, nails, teeth, and skin, we can see them already. So what? That's how people are. They can see it all right, but their seeing is incomplete. They don't see with Buddha, the one who knows, the awakened one. They only see the body in the natural way. They only see the body visually. Simply to see the body is not enough. If one merely sees the body, there's trouble. One must further see the body within the body. Then things become clear. If one merely sees the body, one gets fooled by it. One is charmed by the beauty of it. One doesn't see anicchang, dukkhang, anatta, or kamachanda, delight in objects of the senses. One is still fascinated by form, sound, smells, taste, and bodily sensations. Seen in this way is seen with the mundane eye of the flesh. One only knows that one loves this person and hates that person, that this is beautiful and that's not. The Buddha taught that this is not enough. One must see with the mind's eye as well. See the body within the body. If one looks within the body, looking inward at what's there, ugh, it's really repulsive. There are things there today that were there yesterday. One can't tell what's what. In this way, one will see more clearly than by simply looking with the eyes. Contemplate. Observe with the eyes of the mind, with the wisdom eye. See with wisdom. Therefore, outlookers can differ like this. Some people, if taught to contemplate kesa, loma, naka, danta, tacho, don't know what there is to contemplate. They say they can see these things already, but they see only with their flesh eye, with the madman's eye. It only looks at what it wants to look at. What isn't attractive, it won't have anything to do with it. It picks up, it chooses what it likes. When we say to see the body within the body, it means to see more clearly than that. This practice is the one which can uproot clinging to the five khandhas. If one uproots attachment, it's just the same as if one were uprooting suffering because of the five khandhas are the base of suffering. If suffering arises, it arises here, at the clinging to the five khandhas. It's not that the five khandhas in themselves are suffering, but the clinging to the five khandhas, attachment to them as being oneself, that's suffering. If one clearly sees the truth of the matter, though, through meditation, then suffering will become unwound, just like a screw or a bolt. When one unwinds it and it withdraws, it's not tightly fixed, not taut as when we turn it clockwise. The mind withdraws like this. It lets go. It relinquishes. It's not tightly bound up with good or evil, within possessions, praise, blame, status, happiness, or suffering. If we don't know the truth of these things, it's like tightening the screw all the time. One screws it down until it's crushing one. One suffers over everything. If one knows what's what, with these matters it's like unwinding the screw. In Dhamma language, this is called the arising of nibbida, disenchantment. One is wary of these things, so one lays down the fascination, infatuation, and attachment to them. And if one unwinds, the clinging to those things is really at peace. For example, with regard to the head, in Thailand, here the head is really important. One can't touch it. If one touches a person's head in the streets, they'd probably bash you. This is because he hasn't consented. But if the person has consented, like the military officers who come to see me, then it's okay. I can touch their heads and it's okay. They even like it. However, they only agree to it on that occasion. If I met them in the street and touched their heads, they might clobber me. Here is where suffering arises, at clinging. I've been to some overseas countries where people, regardless of sex, can go and touch each other's heads. And actually, they're right in a way, too. If one doesn't cling, then it's really all right. When one comes to Thailand, one can touch a person's knees. There's no offense. We don't regard that as important. But when it comes to touching someone's head, we really take offense. It's really important. This is clinging. Actually, all the parts of our body are the same, but this is one part we really hold on to and so tie ourselves up with more and more attachments. That's the cause. That's the cause of the arising of suffering. So we should get rid of the cause, cut off its root, and not allow it to be a base for suffering to arise. For example, if one contemplates the body, it's all the same. The lower parts, the sides, the head are all much the same. If one thinks about it, even if someone were to come up and slap one's face, it's all the same. It doesn't matter. This is to be the one who has let go of the cause of suffering. People only have this one problem, the problem of clinging. Just because of this one thing, people will kill each other. Just because of this, nothing more. Whether talking about individuals, family, or national problems, there's nothing else. Nobody wins. They kill each other. But in the end, no one gets anything. I don't know why they go on like that, just killing each other pointlessly. There's power, possessions, status, praise, happiness, and suffering. These are the worldly dhammas, the dhammas which swamp worldly beings. Worldly beings are led around by the worldly dhammas, gain and loss, status and loss of status, praise and criticism, happiness and suffering. These dhammas are insidious. They lead us to trouble. If one doesn't reflect on their true nature, one will suffer. One could even commit murder for wealth, status, and power. And why? Because if we don't understand them, we take them too seriously. One is appointed to this or that position, perhaps head of a village or city councilor, this or that, and one becomes that position. An old man once told me about a certain obnoxious village headman. After they had appointed him as head of the village, he became power drunk. If his old friends came to see him for a chat, he wouldn't associate with them as before. He'd say, "Don't come around here now. Things are different." Be it possessions, status, praise, or happiness, the Buddha taught to understand their nature. Take those things as they come and let them be. Don't be changed by them. If one doesn't really understand possessions, status, praise, criticism, and so on, one may even kill over them. One becomes fooled by one's power, by one's children, by one's relatives, by everything. If one understands them clearly, one knows that they're all much the same. They are only impermanent conditions, and yet when clung to, they become defiled. They are called worldly dhammas. Worldly beings are led around by these things. There is the Buddhist teaching which states that all these things arise subsequently. When people are first born, they are simply rupa and nama, form and mentality. That's all. We add on the Mr. Jones or whatever later. This is done according to convention. Still later, we add the business of general or colonel or whatever. If one doesn't really know these things, one thinks that they are real and so carries them around. One carries possessions, status, name, and reputation around. If one has power, one calls all the tunes. One can do anything. Take this person and execute him. Take that one and throw him into jail. One has power because of one's rank. The word rank here is where upadana, clinging, takes hold. As soon as one gets rank, one starts giving orders, right or wrong. One just acts on one's own power, on one's own moods. So one just goes on making the same old mistakes, deviating further and further from the Dhamma. If one already knows the practice of Dhamma, one won't behave like that. Good and evil have been in this world since who knows when. When possessions and status accrue to us, then let them be simply the possessions, simply the status, but don't let them become one's identity. Just use them to fulfill one's obligations and leave it at that. One is just as before. If we have meditated on these things, no matter what accrues to us, we won't be fooled by it. We will be untroubled, unaffected, constant. Everything is pretty much the same. There's not a great deal to it. Now, this is how the Buddha wanted us to contemplate in order to know the truth of things. No matter what one receives, the mind has nothing to concoct or add to it. They appoint one as city councilor. Okay, sure, I'm the city councilor, but I'm not. They appoint one as head of the village. Okay, so I am, but I'm not. Whatever they make you, yes, I am, but I'm not. In the end, what are we anyway? We all just die in the end. Whether they appoint one as city council or village headman, in the end it's all the same. What can one say? If one can see it like this, one will be really constant, firm, and stable. Nothing has changed. This is the one who isn't fooled. Whatever they give us, it's just that, simply sankhara. There's nothing which can lead this mind to create or concoct. There's nothing which can seduce it again. There are no longer any conditions which can seduce the mind into raga, dosa, moha, lust, aversion, and delusion. Now this is to be one who is nurturing Buddhism. Whether we are among those who are being nurtured, the Sangha, or those who are nurturing, the laity, let us thoroughly consider this. Let the Sila Dhamma arise within us. In short, this is the surest way to nurture Buddhism, to nurture it by giving food, shelter, medicine, are correct also, but they are only correct insofar as the soft woods of Buddhism is concerned. All you lay devotees who have come to listen to Dhamma and cultivate good tendencies today should not forget this. A tree has bark, softwood, and heartwood. These three points are interdependent. There is heartwood due to the presence of the bark. There is the bark because of the softwood. There is softwood due to the heartwood. They come together just like the three teachings of Sila, Samadhi, and Punya. Sila is established through one's speech and actions in uprightness. Samadhi is firmly establishing the mind. Punya is through understanding of the sankharas. Study this, practice this, and one will be one who nurtures Buddhism in the most profound way. If we don't realize these things within us, then if one has many possessions, one will be fooled by them. If one has status, one will be fooled by it. Whatever one has, one will be fooled by it. That's the way it is. If we only nurture Buddhism in the external way, the arguments and squabblings will never cease. The building of grudges and feuds between people will never cease. The stabbing and shooting will never cease. If they are to cease, we must contemplate the matter of possessions, status, praise, happiness, and suffering. We must contemplate our practice and bring it into line with Sila Dhamma. We should reflect that all beings in the world are part of one whole. We are like them. They are like us. They have happiness. They have suffering. And so do we. It's all much the same. If one contemplates in this way, peace and understanding will arise. This is the foundation of Buddhism. One who nurtures Buddhism must develop Sila, Samadhi, and Punya until they are constantly with one. This is to be one who nurtures Buddhism in the right way. On this occasion, the expounding of the Dhamma seems to be adequate for now. Finally, may you all set your minds firm on contemplating what you have heard today so that you can nurture Buddhism with true practice. May you all be happy. Ajahn Chah. So I'll end it there. Sadhu, 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 anumodaya.